Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, April the 15th. On this week's show, we'll cover everything from climate change to COVID to lobbying. I'll be speaking to Stanley Johnson about the government's ambitious green plans and to Christopher Mayer about how good a foreign policy the whole global warming approach of the government is. And just how many lobbyists does the failed financier Lex Greensill have in Whitehall? Who knows? Anyway, all that to come in the next hour of Public Service TV at its finest. Now, if you enjoy what we do here at Spectator TV, why not take out a subscription to The Spectator magazine? It's the fastest growing current affairs publication in Europe, and within its pages and on our website, you can read all your favorite Spectator TV contributors. We'll even throw in a £20 Amazon gift voucher, all for free, if you sign up at spectator.co.uk/TV offer. Or just Google Spectator TV. That's a subscription of 12 issues for £12, plus a free £20 Amazon voucher. Do the arithmetic. It's a no-brainer. And as ever, a very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted that they're partners with us in this venture. Now, David Cameron, there's a name you didn't think you'd hear much about ever again. For in recent weeks, the former Prime Minister has dominated the news agenda for his somewhat cack-handed attempts to generate more pocket money for himself by lobbying on behalf of a financier called Lex Greensill. This week, new revelations emerged that a senior civil servant was employed by both Greensill and the Cabinet Office. That's right, by Greensill and the Cabinet Office, which is at the heart of government. The Johnson government has announced an inquiry into the whole affair, but has blocked a parliamentary inquiry. So how many more skeletons are in the lobby closet? I'm joined now by our deputy political editor, Katie Bowles, and by Jill Rutter. She's a senior research fellow at the think tank UK in a Changing Europe. She's a former civil servant. Katie, this story seems to be developing now and broadening out, not just from David Cameron, but to the whole way the core of Whitehall seems to conduct its business with lobbyists. Give us the background.
Yes, it rather than dying out, is actually ramping up. And I think that we had a situation, you know, a couple of weeks ago where it was more an embarrassing story of David Cameron. Now, that's still the case. We've had a photo this week of his camp out in the desert when he was trying to charm the Saudi prince, more glamping. But ultimately now, I think in terms of Westminster, we've gone from questions from ministers to widespread, is this an institutional issue? Now, Rishi Sunak is someone who's seen that as though they need to answer questions, as has Matt Hancock, who had a drink with David Cameron over the Greensill saga. But as you mentioned in your introduction, we also now have the arrival of civil servants on the scene. Bill Crothers, someone who was in the Cabinet Office as an official, but also at the same time briefly working for Greensill. Now, I think that moving this to the civil service as well has seen a letter from Simon Case, the top civil servant, ultimately asking everyone to come forward in terms of permanent secretaries and say now if there are any such conflicts of interest in their departments on civil servants. Because while you have a situation where MPs and also journalists who work in Parliament have to register their interests, there isn't such a thing for civil servants. And there is a sense that this could go much deeper. In terms of where the Prime Minister is on this, so far, I think the pressure seems to be more on his cabinet and now civil servants than himself. But we're already seeing how a huge wage of war on lobbying as a politician, it could come back to bite you with reports about his interactions with the Saudi Arabia prince.
Jill, some of us were not entirely surprised that David Cameron was lobbying on behalf of interests that were paying him. It happens. We were a bit surprised at how useless he seemed to be at it. What has surprised, I think, everybody, including myself, is this idea that you can be a civil servant at the heart of government and also working for somebody in the private sector, which I believe is what this civil servant, Bill Crothers, has been doing. That must have surprised you too.
Yeah, it surprised me a lot. And I was getting emails from former senior civil servants saying, don't think this happened in my time. The defence from the Cabinet Office that this was not uncommon, I think most people found very, very surprising. And that's, of course, what we'll see as a response to this Simon Case initiative to actually ask. I think if it reveals that there's a lot of this going on, then I think lots of questions will be asked. I mean, you know, Bill Crothers, obviously quite an interesting appointment himself, came in from the private sector. He'd been a long-standing partner, one of the big consultancy firms, not arguably a man who would be in need of a bit of private sector experience. I mean, in some cases, civil servants are encouraged to take up positions as non-executive directors or charity trustees and things like that to give them a bit of exposure. We have secondments programmes because it's generally thought that you don't want civil servants who've basically never left their government department building get a bit of a clue of what's going on in the real world. But the fact that somebody with loads of private sector experience did this and did this in a way that then allowed him to smooth a very easy transition once he left without having to go through any of the checks, the pretty feeble checks that we have in place, looks even more bizarre.
I mean, you say that, and it came from one of his emails, I think, that Bill Crothers said that his arrangements are not uncommon in the civil service. I mean, that's news to me. It seems like it's news to you as well. If it's not uncommon, do we know when it started? Because I don't think it's always been part of the Whitehall firmament.
So I think there may have been occasions when you had people say where the family ran a business and they had some directorship of some sort of smallish company and things like that, that they would have should have said, is it okay if I go on doing this or whatever? I think actually the biggest exception that we've seen is with the man who probably signed off the Crothers appointment as okay, which was John Manzoni. If you remember, John Manzoni was recruited in from BP first to run a thing called Major Projects Authority, regarded as quite a big catch to get somebody who'd been quite a big beast in the corporate world, albeit with a rather tarnished reputation by the time he rocked up in government, to come and run that. And then he moved to be what was called Chief Executive of the Civil Service, so, and Permanent Secretary at the Cabinet Office. And there's a big argument about whether he could hold on to a non-executive directorship he had at SAB Miller, a South African brewery. Now, people seem to be relaxed about that while he was doing the Major Projects Authority, because you could argue the government's not going to ask a big South African brewing company to build a major piece of infrastructure or do a big new IT refit sort of thing that the MPA looked at. But then he was, you know, forced after a bit of an outcry to stand down from that when he became there. So he might have thought it was much more normal practice than the rest of us do. But I mean, that's the really interesting thing, as Katie was mentioning. When we see those answers to Simon Case's letter, does that defence hold up for a second? I think a lot of people at the top of the civil service would be seriously surprised if the not uncommon defence holds water, because I think it's a very rare event. Though, of course, loads of ex-civil servants do go on, in the most senior ranks, to a mass array of board appointments. That's slightly regarded as sort of way of securing their lifetime income. I forswore a bit of the income I'd have got as a partner in a big consultancy firm, big law firm, left with my nice pension, but I will now supplement my retirement with a bit of a few board appointments. And actually, the former permanent secretary at the Foreign Office, Simon Fraser, went on to set up his own lobbying company, something called Flint Global, and he's been attracting quite a lot of former civil service talent to swell his ranks.
Katie, when this story first emerged around David Cameron, it sort of struck me that this was what the Americans would call an inside the beltway story. But it may no longer be that, as it's grown and grown and grown. Are there signs that it's having political cut through to the country, to the wider country?
Well, as you say, I mean, it's early days in terms of gauging that, but certainly Labour believe it is a story that will have cut through. And you saw Keir Starmer at PMQs this week, really quite a comfortable and one of his more assured performances after quite a tricky period for him, where he was going on the attack and quite clearly wants to make it a Tory sleaze scandal. And I think that we have seen, you know, with previous Conservative governments, that actually if there is a pattern, if there is a narrative, if you can get people to associate what can be quite a tacky story in terms of who did what and when, then I think that you get to a situation where it could start to dent them if it does look as though, you know, politicians looking out for each other, it's an inside game. I think what will be interesting is almost if this is completely institutional, if, and Jill's right, I think, to be sceptical, but if the Bill Provost defence holds up, that actually it's common, at least during this period, to have, you know, multiple jobs as a civil servant, some with conflicts of interest, then I think it moves away from being a Conservative-specific scandal. But again, I think there is scepticism that that is going to be the case. And we also have multiple inquiries. So you see the Prime Minister almost wanting to put clear blue water between himself and what's happened to say that he takes a strong stance. But I think it is damaging to the party as a whole, despite that.
Jill, some people might say that what David Cameron attempted to do was inappropriate. It was a misuse of his position as a former prime minister in the way he lobbied for something in which he had a clear commercial stake. But in the end, he didn't get anywhere. In the end, what he wanted to happen didn't happen. He was brushed off, pushed back. And so in the end, perhaps the system worked. What would you say to that?
The system seems to have worked. I think, you know, when we get to the results of all these inquiries that Katie mentions, we'll see whether they did do that. There are some aspects, clearly, of the government loan schemes that Greensill did seem to be able to access, or at least its clients with the Liberty Steel collapse and things like that. So we'll see whether he was really as hopeless a lobbyist as it looks. But actually, you know, the mere fact that he's taking up a lot of sort of public time and money. Look at all those meetings he got. One of Labour's lines of attack was this was a time when the Chancellor was saying he didn't have time to meet people like the self-employed who felt they were very hard done by and missed out. But he was racking up a lot of meetings, he or his senior officials, with the Greensill guys. You know, this was a time when people were focusing a lot on designing schemes to help out the whole economy. Did it actually lead to people having to waste quite a lot of time, money and effort just to try and, you know, assure the chance that really they had explored every angle of this scheme that David Cameron was pushing? So even if it came to nothing, you could say that it wasted quite a bit of time, attention and effort in Whitehall. And actually, you could say that, you know, what did this do? Ministers being pushed, officials, it takes actually quite robust officials to say no. Treasury officials are quite good at that. Other departments may not be actually so resistant when ministers come threatening shortcuts, might be looking at that. And remember, this is all the time of Dominic Cummings' hard rein, bunch of sort of, yeah, hopeless civil servants, stick to the rules, too bureaucratic by half. Let's just replace them, bop them on the head and replace them with people who might actually adopt a more fleet of foot and responsive approach. So actually some people might have thought, well, if I, you know, my minister is telling me, not David Cameron, but if my minister's saying I'm quite keen on this Cameron scheme, why are we saying no? They might actually at the end of the day cave in. So I don't think we can take the fact that he was resisted this time as evidence that everything is hunky-dory.
Katie, I think we'll almost certainly end up with new rules governing lobbying when these inquiries are done and when we learn more about Mr. Cameron's behaviour and how Greensill somehow managed to insert himself into the heart of government as well. That's clear that there will be some tougher rules, I think. But I think I would suggest, Katie, that what's even more clear is that David Cameron's reputation will never recover.
I agree. And I think that, I mean, I think in Spectator publications, you rarely hear too much praise for Theresa May. But I think this is one area where actually the former Prime Minister comes out much better than David Cameron and some others here, just in the sense that David Cameron used to talk about how it was important that politicians stuck around after front bench careers, after being Prime Minister in the Commons. It added to the weight of the debate and people shouldn't, you know, just shoot off. And then obviously when push came to shove, that's exactly what he did. I think people were already quite sceptical and questioning of his words and what he did. And I think that you add to this lobbying scandal now, I think it is affecting David Cameron's legacy in a very negative way, and it was already pretty negative.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Joe Rutter, thanks for joining us on Spectator TV. No doubt we'll be coming back to this subject. Katie, you have to stay with us because you've done the cover story for The Spectator this week. It's on what's called COP26. It is the big climate change global summit. It was meant to take place in Glasgow last November. COVID stopped that. The government hopes it can do so again this November, rescheduled it for them, though that is by no means certain. The one thing is clear, Katie, is that although it's not clear if anybody else yet is going to turn up, the British government itself is putting a lot of store by this Glasgow summit.
Yes, I think climate summit, 12-day negotiations, you know, over 100 nations and powers coming together doesn't really scream crowd pleaser. But in government, this is being seen as a big moment for Boris Johnson, his reset moment, bruising few years, yes, in terms of the pandemic, but also Brexit. And I think COP26 might not roll off the tongue, but it's ultimately that moment where they will try and forge their post-pandemic agenda by uniting the world, but also the nation, the British public, in a green frenzy of environmentalism. I mean, if the plan goes to plan.
When I read your cover story, Katie, it's not clear to me whether the reason for the enthusiasm in Whitehall for this is because they want a wonderful game-changing climate change summit in Glasgow, or whether it's all part of Boris Johnson's post-Brexit relaunch, which is the more important.
I mean, I think it depends who you speak to. I think that when you look at the climate summit, it clearly ties with the UK's international aims. We recently had the Integrated Review, and actually climate change and biodiversity were put as our number one international aim. So it is a large part, front and centre, also of our foreign policy. And I think that when you look at Boris Johnson trying to cozy up with Joe Biden, COP26 is seen as a good way to do that because the UK is hosting, but also the environmental agenda is where I think the UK government believe they will have the most common ground because the US is also pushing very hard on this. But then I think where you get to this domestic audience is we have seen, a few months ago, a departure of Vote Leave aides from Downing Street. And I think that at the time, some, we said in the magazine, said this was the beginning of a reshaping, a new tone to Boris Johnson's government. I think that is starting to come to fruition. And newer aides, I think new Johnson allies, really think that you have to expand the Tory coalition. They think that the past years have been quite divisive for the country. And they think that the climate agenda is how that you are going to do that. So I think there is an international aim here, but very much there is a domestic one. And that is something that really animates both the Prime Minister and those around him.
Let me bring in Christopher Mayer, the former British ambassador to Washington. He's been listening to you, Katie, follows these things. Christopher, what do you make of this? It seems that this summit is now as much to do with the Johnson foreign policy as it is with climate change.
Well, foreign policy and environmentalism are completely intertwined in this conference, as they were back in 2015 when we had the famous or notorious Paris Climate Change Conference. And I read Kate Andrews' article with extreme interest, because if this is the way Downing Street are approaching the Glasgow conference in November, they have to be very careful they're not heading for a fall, because the answer, what everybody will want from this conference, is a quote unquote success. But success does not lie in the hands of the British government, even if it is the host for the conference. The most important thing happening for the Glasgow conference, as we speak, Andrew, I think, is that John Kerry, appointed by President Biden to be the senior person on climate change, is today in Beijing talking to the Chinese about the environment and the upcoming conference. Because why? China, by a margin, by a big margin, and the United States, by a lesser margin, are the world's two biggest polluters and therefore have to do more to achieve the objectives of this conference than anybody else. That is where the answer lies, and it will be either a skillful British government or a failed British government that manages to act as honest broker between these two super polluters.
I should just point out, it's Katie Bowles who wrote the article this week, not Kate Andrews. We've got lots of Katies.
I always get my Kates muddled up. Apologies to Katie Bowles.
Let me go to Katie Bowles. I mean, what Christopher says, of course, is quite right. China and America between them account for almost 50% of CO2 emissions. China now a lot more in absolute terms than America. Just one thing, Kitty. Do we have any indication yet as to whether America and or China are coming to Glasgow?
Well, it all relies on COVID. So while we know that the US government is very keen to take part in this, and I think that the behind-the-scenes works that Christopher touches on in the sense of John Kerry, also working with Alok Sharma, who's the minister in charge of this summit, but I think John Kerry has definitely seemed to hold more weight when it comes to certain international discussions. They do want to be a role, but ultimately there's some talk of where this summit's going to have to be virtual. Now, the UK government is pushing really hard against this. I think partly because they think in terms of this quite complex negotiation, it's better to have people in a room than on Zoom, but also because they think it's an important event to show they are leading physically. But if I think COVID does not go in the way that people want in terms of the easing of the pandemic, you could have a situation where certain countries do not turn up. And on China, I think that is obviously going to be the hardest sell, and it's already causing ripples in the Tory party because we have a hawkish Tory party that wants a harder stance on China. But yet, in order to get this agreement, there is a sense that you are going to have to, if you know, get China to do one thing for you, they will perhaps expect you to offer concessions on other things. Everything is intertwined here.
Christopher, if it can't take place as a summit as we used to know them and has been done in Zoom, that doesn't have the same political impact. I mean, I can see how Mr. Johnson would like to be welcoming the Chinese president and the American president and everybody else to the fair city of Glasgow and be seen to be the ringmaster for a brief period. That doesn't really come across on Zoom, does it? He doesn't get the political fallout from a Zoom conference.
No, he doesn't. But Andrew, it may be a blessing in disguise, because having looking at Katie Bowles, getting the right Katie here.
Well done.
Account, it does seem to me that right now Downing Street is heading for a fall, because supposing you have this thing physically, but supposing COVID allows it and everybody over 190 delegations decide to turn up, you're going to have around the Glasgow Centre a howling mob of Extinction Rebellion putting pressure on the delegates, because the Extinction Rebellion regard the Paris conference 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, as a failure. And so what the thousands and thousands of members who support the Greta Thunberg on this want is an improvement. Now, this may be very hard to handle physically. It's not going to help having Sturgeon lurking in the background, determined that this will not be a success on Scottish soil for a British Prime Minister in the shape of Boris Johnson. So I can see a virtual meeting, maybe with fewer member states taking part, making it easier to arrive at an accommodation which can be seen to be an improvement on Paris. Because I thought the most terrifying thing in your article, Katie, was where you said something like, in Downing Street, there is a view to have everybody in the room will make an agreement easier. I can tell you, having everybody in the room will make getting an agreement infinitely more difficult. And if you look at the successful conferences in recent years, and indeed going back to the Congress of Vienna, 1814, 1815, these are conferences which either officially or unofficially choose an inner sanctum of four or five leading member states who broker an agreement between them, with the help of the British one, hopes this time in real or virtual Glasgow, which is then accepted by the rest of the membership of the conference. That may be easier to achieve virtually than in reality.
It's very interesting, because I hadn't really thought of that, though it does deny, as interest of seeing Extinction Rebellion come up against the Glasgow police. but that may just be a sideshow, but I would warn them that I'm not sure they know what's about to happen. Katie, how are the Tories taking to this new climate change Johnson? The man that when David Cameron said, vote blue, go green, I think wrote quite a few editorials in a magazine called The Spectator, which he edited, disparaging all of that.
Yes, I think, I mean, the conversion of Boris Johnson to, keen environmentalist, and now anyone in Downing Street will say, this is the subject he is the most enthusiastic about in meetings, the most keen. I think as we met with scepticism in some parts of the party, lots of people put it down to his family, his fiancé, the people he hangs out with more now, as many of whom are keen environmentalists. But I think there is still quite a lot of enthusiasm in the Tory party for a few reasons. One, the government keeps talking about green jobs. So the website Conservative Home says they are just besieged with Tory MPs. He's desperate to write about green jobs, hoping some, I presume, will come to their constituency. Two, it's very in vogue, obviously, in terms of number 10. So if you are an environmentalist, you perhaps will fare well in this government. But three, I think that it does tap into a wider enthusiasm in the public on green issues and the environment, which I think in all polling suggests it has risen in recent years. But I think where there is a potential problem for this government is that, yes, lots of people, if you do a poll, say, no, I really care about the planet, we should save the planet. And I think that is countrywide, that there's very similar polling, whether you're in a town or a city on that, or, a village. But when you get to the trickier questions, which is, we have a net zero target 2050. How do you feel about a ban on gas boilers? How do you feel about having to potentially get an electric car in, under 10 years or, 15 years? That's when actually you get a lot more resistance. And therefore, I think that it's not very fashionable at the moment in the Tory party to raise those concerns. I think Steve Baker will do it, which normally suggests it's an unpopular cause if he's having to be the chief rebel. But I think there is a creeping concern amongst some of the Red Wall MPs, so the 2019 intake, that perhaps the trade-offs here in pushing this green agenda are not being presented as a reality, which is that ultimately there is going to be a cost to this and who is going to pay for it.
Final question to you, Christopher, on this. It would seem from what you said earlier, whether it's an actual summit or a Zoom, a virtual summit, unless in the lead up to it, that there is the outline of an agreement between America and China above all, unless the sort of building, it doesn't have to be signed, sealed and delivered before the summit, but unless the building blocks are clear between these two countries about an agreement, there won't be an agreement, it'll be a failure.
I think that's absolutely right. It would be a failure. And if I were sitting at the heart of British government now, and thank the Lord I'm not, what I would be doing is even now starting to decide what the realistic outcome we can expect from this conference. What will it be? What will we be asking of the Americans? What will we be asking of the Chinese? What will we be asking of, to mention to other big polluters, the EU? And what will we be asking of India and other medium-sized polluters like Turkey? And Iran, and can we construct a set of conclusions that stands a chance of being accepted by the membership? I would expect people to be working on that right now. The other thing to bear in mind is that we all say this is the return of multilateral diplomacy, the kind of thing that Donald Trump despised. Well, it is multilateral diplomacy, but it's kind of bilateral diplomacy and national policy in drag. It's not real multilateral negotiation around a huge table. China, the United States, everybody else have got to decide how they see the progression of their domestic economic development and how this fits in to some kind of environmental vision. So although we're being nasty to China right now because of the Uyghurs and Hong Kong and all that, in the end, it won't be that decides the Chinese one way or another to play nice in Glasgow. It'll be a hard-headed calculation they will make between making ourselves look better in the world by subscribing to climate change objectives and how do we see our economic development. always remembering that the objectives set in Paris 5 years ago were political and non-binding aspirations. And all the big polluters have failed to meet those targets which they signed up for 5.5 years ago.
Christopher Mayer, Katie Bowles, we'll leave it there. Thanks for being with us on Spectator TV, but we stick with the subject of climate change. I'm joined now by Stanley Johnson, former MEP, vocal Green campaigner, and the International Ambassador for the Conservative Environment Network. Of course, the father of the Prime Minister too. Maybe one of the pressures on the Prime Minister to go more green over the years. Stanley Johnson, welcome to Spectator TV. I want to concentrate on what will the cost be of getting to net zero emissions by 2050, which is the explicit aim of the British government. Are you able to tell us what the net cost will be by 2050?
Well, I can give you some conclusions, if you like, of what the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate concluded on this. And that was set up by seven countries, and that included the United Kingdom. And they concluded that the transitioning to a low carbon sustainable growth path could deliver a direct economic windfall of $26 trillion and create over 75 million new jobs by 2030 compared with business as usual. So that's the advantage. And then the Energy Transition Commission showed that decarbonizing hard to abate sectors such as steel, aluminium, cement and heavy transport is technically feasible by 2050 with the technology that already exists, and the total cost to the global economy would be less than 0.5% of GDP by mid-century and could be reduced even further. I think the point I want to make, Andrew, is that this is really a no-brainer in terms of the amount of money it costs when you consider that this country alone has mobilized. This is it 400 billion pounds for COVID? Well, what was Paris asking a few years ago? Paris was asking for 100 billion a year to be mobilized. Well, I think you can see, therefore, that the idea that we are unable to afford to deal with climate change is totally ludicrous. This is an existential issue far more important than COVID ever was, infinitely more important.
Well, the British Committee on Climate Change, which is full of like-minded people like yourself, says that it's going to cost, we will need to spend £50 billion a year until 2050. That accumulates to £1.5 trillion. If it's a no-brainer that we should be doing that, why is the government nowhere near spending that kind of money?
Well, partly because of the free rider issue. This does need to be seen a little bit in the context of a global agreement, or at least as Christopher was saying a moment ago, in the context of agreement between the major parties involved. That's why Glasgow is important, because what went wrong at Paris was not the targets they set, the 1.5 or the 2, but what has gone wrong is that none of the so-called national determined contributions, when you add them all up together, they simply don't get us on track for that.
But I'm sticking with the Britain at the moment, and the government's own climate change committee says 50 billion a year. Far from spending anything like that now, in fact, it's cutting back. It's only recently that the government scrapped the green home grants that allowed retrofitting homes to make them more energy efficient. Scrapped. Public Accounts Committee concluded that the government, quote, lacks a plan to reach its net zero by 2050 target. So we've got the rhetoric. I don't see any sign of the money being spent or the plan to achieve it.
Well, I think the carbon committee, the thing which Lord Deben chairs, has indeed made those criticisms. The key issue is actually not necessarily what happens in 2050. The key issue may be what happens in 2030. Now, the government has committed itself to get a substantial reduction. I think it's a 60% reduction by 2030 on the so-called 1990 targets, which effectively is saying more or less halfway, well, we have to be halfway there. Now, on the money point, that money doesn't all have to be spent by the government. And let's be clear about that. I mean, the mobilization of the private sector here is tremendously important. And it is going on. I mean, Mark Carney has been established as the private advisor to the president of the climate change conference, Alok Sharma. And I imagine he's doing a pretty good job about mobilizing private finance. And I have certainly attended meetings recently where bankers are beginning to realize that if they fail to support, as it were, climate-friendly projects, or if they go even further in the other direction and support non-friendly projects, they could get into trouble. They could even be sued. So we are, I think, going to move in the right direction here.
Well, we've moved in the right direction in terms of broad brush promises, but it's the actual policies and money required to deliver that I'm still trying to find. For example, another broad brush promise was the pledge by the government to protect 30% of UK land and sea for conservation. Can you point to any action that's been taken to implement that?
Yeah, let's get on to this for a second. On the on this issue of targets, if I could just step back for one moment on the target thing, I would agree with you. There is a problem. The Environment Bill going through Parliament at the moment does not include the kind of definitive targets which you've just referred to. The Prime Minister has on several occasions, including on international meetings, said, yes, we are committed to the 30% target by 1930 for marine and terrestrial systems in terms of protection. Now, in terms of marine systems, it is perfectly possible that we can be there because we can include the overseas territories. As far as land is concerned, yes, it does mean that there's a need for a further big push on protected areas. I came into this whole business years and years and years ago. One of the things I did most recently was in the European Commission to write the Habitats Directive. And the Habitats Directive has led to something like 18% of the land of this country being protected.
But my question was to get you to point to what action has been taken to meet this pledge.
Well, what action has been taken is we have, for example, transferred all the sites under the Habitats Directive into UK law, and we have a set of sites of special scientific interest. We have the national parks. We are not far off the 30% figure as far as terrestrial sites are concerned. Like, that is a fact, Andrew. You can verify that. We're not far off, and I think there will be pressure on the government in this next few weeks as the Environment Bill comes back to Parliament to put these targets actually in law in the Environment Bill.
Oh, do you think that the politicians and campaigners like yourself are being honest with the British people? I mean, for example, do you think that the British people are aware that to meet this target of net zero by 2050, that every gas boiler, every gas heater in the land will have to be replaced?
Yes, I think the British people are becoming increasingly aware of that. And I think they're becoming increasingly aware that the technologies exist for those transitions to be achieved. Honestly, I think we are in a different area now. And of course, the important thing is for people to realize that it's not just 2050 we've got to look at, it's also 2030 we've got to look at. So I think we are going to get there. But someone was right when they said a lot of this will of course depend on political will. I mean, the government has a majority at the moment and can carry things through. We need to be sure it continues to do that over a period of years.
What's the technology that will replace the gas boiler?
Well, one of them is the hydrogen-based technology. Another one is the ground heat pump.
Ground heat pumps struggle in extremes of temperature, either lots of heat or lots of cold. And hydrogen is very expensive and on a mass scale as yet untested.
Well, I'm not saying there are not going to be technological problems. There are, but you've got people out there who are ready to put private capital.
But have you been honest with the British people that this is what they'll have to do? Because when I speak to people about this, not politicians, but just voters, they had no idea that the gas boiler was going to be replaced.
Well, I think these are messages, therefore, which need to be got across, and I think they will be got across. The transformations are beginning to happen in the transport sector. I think we are seeing a shift now to electric vehicles. The crucial sector of agriculture, I think, will see a lot of transformations in this country. I link this also to the biodiversity issue, which has come up several times in the conversation. That, by the way, and you said it before, is one of the government's twin challenges. Climate change, yes, and biodiversity, yes. The transformations in agriculture are tremendously important, and they have to happen.
You've been happy to be associated with Extinction Rebellion. You said you were one of the happy to be, I quote you, an uncooperative crusty on such matters.
I remember that.
Roger Hallam, one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, has said that climate change will kill 6 billion people in the decades ahead, and that was, quote, based on hard science. Do you know what hard science that was based on?
I personally don't know what hard science that was based on, but what I will say is that it is perfectly clear that the impact of climate change over the next decades is going to be very, very severe, not just in economic terms, but also in terms of mortality and morbidity and so on and so forth like that. So, I mean, for my money, the Extinction Rebellion are completely right when they point out these sorts of things. I don't know about the six billion figure.
Well, either it's right or it's wrong.
I'm sorry,
we don't know science.
No, I'm so sorry.
Billion. It can't be both.
No, of course it can. If you're looking to the future and you're making predictions of the future, nobody knows whether those predictions are right or wrong. That's not hard science.
Right. Okay. Let me just ask you about China, which we were talking about earlier. What do we do if China says, okay, we'll cooperate with you on global policies to combat climate change, but stop lecturing us about human rights?
What's our response? There's no issue in my mind. We absolutely have to work with China on climate change and on biodiversity. These are existential issues of huge importance, and it is not within our power, I think, as serious players in public policy, to say we will not work with China as we try and face the climate change and biodiversity issues. That doesn't mean to say
so we sacrifice the Uyghurs for cooperation on climate change.
Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say anybody needs to be sacrificed. What I will say is the Chinese have to realize, and I'm sure they do realize, that the evolution of policy is not going to go in their direction. They cannot in the end maintain, as were the line they are taking on Uyghurs, I'm sure of that. But I don't think you can say it's a question of trading one for the other.
But the Chinese may well say that. You need our help to meet the climate change targets. Without us, you can't do it. But we're not going to help. If you keep on complaining about what's happening to the Uyghurs, Hong Kong, and our build-up of military off the coast of Taiwan, or you're calling what's happening to the Uyghurs genocide, you do all that. We're not helping. And by the way, we're still building more coal-fired stations than the rest of the world put together.
Well, on your last point, you're right. I think it's tremendously unlikely that the Chinese are going to say, we won't cooperate on climate change unless you pipe down about the Uyghurs and so on. I simply cannot see that, because if there's one country which also needs progress on climate change as much, if not more, than any other country, it is China herself. This is the point. And in fact, we have seen recently the Chinese have said we will try and get to net zero by 2060. With any luck, they'll come in at 2050. And with any luck, we'll see some substantial commitments for peaking by 2030.
Why would they be able to come in at 2050, even 2060, when they are massively increasing their own coal-fired capacity, massively increasing it, plus paying for and building other coal-fired stations all around the Pacific Rim? They're doing that now. Their CO2 emissions in the second half of last year soared. Why would you believe them, that they have any intention of meeting these commitments, when you look at what they're doing?
Well, this is what diplomacy is all about. This is presumably what Mr. Kerry is going to be saying to them in Beijing this week. I couldn't agree with you more. This has to be the basis on which we work. They have to do what they can do and what they will do, and then they have to go beyond that and do it. Yeah, that's what they, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. What China does is going to be vastly important. The good news is that we have a difference now in the American position, which is going to help, I think, enormously.
All right. Stanley Johnson, thank you for being on Spectator TV. Thank you, Bea, for being with us today.
Well,
now, if you enjoy what we do here at Spectator TV, why not take out a subscription to the Spectator magazine? It's the fastest growing current affairs publication in Europe. Within its pages and on our website, you can read all your favorite Spectator TV contributors. We'll even throw in a £20 Amazon gift voucher, all for free, if you sign up at spectator.co.uk/TV offer. Or you can just Google Spectator TV. And you'll see a subscription offer of 12 issues for £12 and that free £20 Amazon voucher. You can do the arithmetic, your quid's in if you take that offer. Now, so far on this edition of Spectator TV, we've not mentioned COVID, or at least covered it, but I'm afraid we are going to now. This week, Boris Johnson said that the fall in cases and hospitalizations and deaths was not a result of the vaccine rollout. I think many people will be surprised by that. But regardless of what Boris, the epidemiologist, thinks, what does the data show? Let's go to Kate Andrews now, our economics editor and editor of our lunchtime briefing email, with the latest data from the Spectator's COVID Data Hub.
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, very strange comments from the Prime Minister this week, putting essentially all the focus on lockdowns for the progress we've made in tackling the virus so far instead of vaccines. So let's have a quick look at the data and where we are now before we dig into that. As you can see from this first slide, infections are down 97% from the peak of the most recent wave. Here we're looking at the 7-day rolling average, and current infection rates are roughly around where they were at the very start of September last year. On this next slide, those being admitted to hospital for COVID are down 96% from the January peak, also hovering around early September rates. And deaths, down a staggering 98% from the peak. London has reported zero COVID deaths for several days this month, including twice this week. Now, that can always be revised upwards, so we take it with a pinch of salt, but it certainly enhances the narrative that the virus is really on the retreat. So is this success story playing out across Europe? The answer is sadly no, Andrew. The graphs I've shown reflect that the UK has experienced one of the fastest falls in case rates around the world. And now, as you can see here, currently has the lowest case rate in Europe. But other countries like France are still struggling to get their cases under control. So if you compare the UK here with the lowest case rates to this next slide, where we have the highest rate for vaccination in Europe by a long way, this brings us on to the Prime Minister's comments this week about what to credit for our success in tackling COVID this time around. Now, the UK for months this winter was in one of the strictest lockdowns in the developed world, and no doubt that played a big role in bringing numbers down. That's what lockdowns do. They suppress the virus, but they can't eliminate it. That wasn't really the controversial part of his comment. It was the emphasis he was putting on vaccines not playing a crucial role in the story so far. And they're comments that head of the NHS, Sir Simon Stevens, has countered, perhaps not intentionally, but certainly in effect, by stating after the PM's comments that, quote, vaccines are successfully reducing hospitalizations and deaths amongst the cohorts that have had the vaccine, end quote. And those are, of course, the people who are the most vulnerable, because we've prioritized the vaccine for the elderly and those most vulnerable to having a severe reaction to this virus in the first place. And the ONS's infection survey backs this up. As you can see from this graph here, it's now estimated that roughly half of Britons have antibody prevalence, with 1 in 2 people in England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland thought to have antibodies. And crucially, it's people in the most elderly age brackets that have the most prevalence. And this is something that Sir Simon Stevens was also keen to highlight, saying, quote, data that we have analyzed shows a 75% reduction in emergency COVID hospitalizations for the vaccine cohorts. And as more and more people are vaccinated, that effect will widen, end quote. So what do we make of this? To be honest, it's very hard to disentangle the lockdown effect and the vaccine factor this time around. The odd thing wasn't that the PM was giving credit to lockdown, but that he once again deliberately was playing down the vaccines. This isn't a one-off. For about a month now, this kind of rhetoric has been on the rise, with lots of focus on vaccines not being 100% effective from both the PM and his officials. Now, that is a true statement, but still a very strange one, because nobody ever, ever thought we'd get a vaccine with 100% efficacy. That the vaccines we're using are as effective as they are, based on the data we currently have, is really nothing short of a scientific miracle. So the question now is, why is there all this caution around talking up the vaccines? What's behind this? Is there real data-driven concern in Downing Street about the possibility of a new variant that can undermine vaccines? Is this an attempt to keep people following the rules for a bit longer, for as long as possible, really, as their older relatives are getting that protection through the vaccine and they're fearful that people might start taking the rules and taking their life into their own hands once again? Well, either way, that's probably the conversation and the honesty that the PM should be having with the nation, rather than what we're getting now, which is quite a muddled rhetoric with the vaccine, which so far is proving to be a big success story. Back over to you, Andrew.
Thank you for that, Kate. If you want to sign up to Kate's daily email, just Google Spectator Lunchtime Briefing. That's Spectator Lunchtime Briefing. Or if you want to see the numbers for yourself, just visit spectator.co.uk/data. Now, as the world ventures back into some kind of normality, at least some parts of the world, vaccine passports have been seen as the way forward by some. Not so in the United States, where President Biden has ruled them out, at least on a federal level. Well, to discuss this and what else is happening in America, I'm joined now by Professor Lawrence Gostin from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He runs the WHO's Center on National and Global Health Law. Professor Gostin, thank you for joining us on Spectator TV. Before we get into the vaccine passports, could you give us just an overview of where America now is with the pandemic?
Well, you know, there's good news and bad. I think for the next 4 to 6 weeks, we're in a perilous position because we've got, you know, enormous pandemic fatigue. Governors are starting up businesses and restaurants. People aren't wearing masks. And we have, particularly prevalent variants, particularly the one that was originally found in the UK, which is causing surges in certain parts of the United States. So we are in a perilous position, say in the next month, but our vaccination campaign is going extraordinarily well. And I think most forecasts are that by this summer, certainly by the autumn, we are going to be pulling our way out of this. So I think it's going to be slow and steady. And then ultimately, I think there'll be some dramatic reductions in particularly hospitalizations and deaths because of the vaccine taking hold. President Biden has said that by the end of May, every American who wants a vaccine can get one. And I think that is realistic, even with the Johnson & Johnson pause.
I saw some overnight concern in Michigan and other parts of the upper Midwest of the variant there, even despite quite a high degree of vaccination taking place, something of a sort of a third wave. It would suggest that we're not out of the woods yet if that's happening.
No, we're not. And that's the fire I was talking about. And there are other places in the United States. I mean, what we've learned from COVID, so very clearly is that, you know, it's not so much as a wave, but as a series of forest fires. And so when one pops out in one part of the United States or the world, and others are feeling, you know, quite good about themselves and complacent, it always moves. And, you know, I do expect that to happen, you know, in the next month, but the United States, as I say, is going to be in a perilous position in that month. And we really do need to be very careful in terms of masking and distancing before the vaccines really, really take hold. But eventually they will, you know, and I've actually seen this movie before. With other major health threats. things like smallpox, polio, even measles and other childhood vaccinations. When you have an extraordinarily good set of vaccines combined with high population coverage, you really can make dramatic differences. And I think we will over the medium to longer term.
What role then do you think vaccine passports would have in Britain, other parts of Europe? It's quite a matter of controversy. I'd like to divide it into two. There are official government vaccine passports is one possibility, which you may need to cross borders or to get into the country or into another country. And then, and this may be particularly relevant in America because of your highly federalized system, 50 states, each of which in some ways can go their own way on this. Do you envisage a situation where either businesses or individual states will be demanding some proof of vaccination before, say, you get into a restaurant or into an office or whatever?
Yeah, Andrew, you've actually put your finger right on it. You know, there are three possibilities. You know, one is the federal government in the United States. And as you said, President Biden has ruled that out. And I think for political and legal reasons, he may be right to do that. Although I do have one criticism I can mention. Then there'll be state governments, which really hold the major public health powers. But most of the action is actually going to be at the private sector level. And already our Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is a federal agency, has said it's entirely lawful for businesses to require employees to show proof of vaccination as a condition of returning to work. And major colleges and universities have been announcing mandatory vaccinations. Georgetown just did it yesterday, partly on my advice. So I think that we are going to see this in the private sector. Now, let me just mention President Biden's position, because, you know, I agree the federal government should not mandate it. I think it would just be a huge backlash and challenged in the courts. But I do think that the federal government should be providing national scientific guidance and technical assistance to whatever state and private entity that wishes to do it. Otherwise, we're going to get a patchwork of, you know, variable inconsistency, just the way we did with testing and ventilators and masking and a whole other things under the Trump administration. So I think it would be wise to provide federal guidance, but not a federal mandate.
I'm interested that you think if I'm a restaurant owner and I'm allowed now to serve meals indoors, that if I say, but to do that, I want to see your vaccine passport, that I won't be litigated to hell. I mean, in the most litigious country in the world, I think you've got more lawyers than the rest of the world put together. Yeah. I mean, is this not a dripping roast for lawyers?
It is. And you know, no matter what, you know, if you've got something that has got a toxic combination of being highly controversial and political, and also you've got a lot of lawyers running around, you will get litigation. You know, certainly, I think one thing is absolutely clear, that businesses can require proof of vaccination of their employees. I think, you know, we've had federal guidance on that. It already happens, you know, with hospitals on flu, at universities with various vaccination requirements, at schools. I think, we are going to see this kind of thing happening. For customers, I also think it will happen. It's a little bit of a gray zone, but I don't think much. I mean, there's this, you'll see signs on a lot of American shops. You might even see them in the UK, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Sure. You actually absolutely are allowed to set standards about, you know, hygiene and health and safety standards for those who you serve. We already require masks, you know, even in states that don't mandate masks. Businesses say, you know, you can't shop here or you can't dine here unless you put on a mask. Same thing with a vaccine. You know, a vaccine, you know, gives you a certain cushion of safety. And I think it's in the economic interests of businesses to make their employees and their customers feel safe. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, there's this huge argument in the United States. I'm sure there is in the UK. I lived there for 15 years and my wife's from the Lake District, so I know it really well. That somehow a requiring a vaccine or proof of vaccination as a condition of service is a violation of my autonomy or my liberty or my rights. Everybody has the right to make any decision about their own health and safety, but they don't have the right to go without a vaccine or without a mask in a crowded place and expose someone else to an infectious disease that could kill them. That's not your right. The biggest issue here is equity and fairness. Yes. We have to make sure that no one is left behind and that everyone who wants a vaccine can get a vaccine. That's why I suggested to Georgetown and to other universities, don't have a vaccine mandate unless you can actually provide a vaccine for anyone who doesn't have it. And we will do that.
And just for clarification, what you couldn't do in America, an individual state couldn't say, you can't come into this state unless you've got a vaccine passport, because the borders between states are totally porous. So they couldn't operate in that way, I'm right in thinking.
Well, yeah, I'd like to as well, but what was standard thought, just as you thought, Andrew, became blurred during the pandemic. And so many states put testing requirements on coming into their states. You know, when New York had its flare up, Florida prevented New York residents and made them show testing requirements. And then when Florida flared up, New York did. And it went on and on. You know, most states did that in one form or another. But normally what that does is say, unless you show me a negative test or a negative or that you've been vaccinated, we'll quarantine you when you come in. Technically, you're absolutely right. As a constitutional matter, you states are not allowed to impede travel from one state to another. That's a federal responsibility.
You sounded that although there may be some rough times in the spring and summer months ahead, that you sounded quite optimistic about America's position overall as we approach the end of this year. Did I pick that up correctly?
You did. And those who followed what I've said publicly, I've always been very dour and pessimistic about this. And after it arose in Wuhan and came to Europe and the US, I said this would take about 2 years before we came out of it. Just historically, that's what pandemics are like. They have 2 year cycles and we're in a period of quite advanced science. And people thought that I was being awfully pessimistic, and I've been pessimistic throughout. But one thing I do know that in the UK, Europe, the United States, for some reason, the virus has been just too much for us to handle. We either won't or can't change our behavior the way that other countries have been able to do. But one thing we're really good at, particularly in the UK and the US, is science and vaccine development and deployment. That's what's going to get us out of this. And so yes, by the autumn and certainly by the end of this year, I think we are going to be approaching, we're not going to be completely normal, we will be approaching more normalcy. We'll probably still for quite a while be masking and distancing. But I do think we'll be, doing the things we really want to do, hug our family and recreate and shop and see our football games.
Well, that's a great note to end on, Professor. Professor Lawrence Gostin, thank you very much for being with us on Spectator TV.
Thanks.
That's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests, and once again to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley, for sponsoring the Weekend 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms. It's one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. A final reminder, pick up that £20 Amazon voucher, all yours for free, if you sign to the Up to the Spectator at spectator.co.uk/TV offer. Or make it easy, just Google Spectator TV and get that voucher, get 12 weeks for £12 of The Spectator. As always, send any thoughts to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. That's it for this week. Join us again next week. Bye-bye.